Hey, this is Swoopy, and you're listening to Skepticality for Tuesday, December 15th, 2009. Welcome back to another episode of Skepticality, the official podcast of Skeptic Magazine, here to bring you more news and interviews with scientists and skeptics from around the world and all walks of life, as well as the investigation of extraordinary claims, revolutionary ideas, and the promotion of science. I don't say that as excitedly as Derek does, and I mean it as excitingly, but he's just got a special way of saying it. But unfortunately, Derek wasn't able to be with me to record this today, so you'll just have to imagine him saying science the way he says it. The response to our last show featuring Dr. William Meller, author of Evolution RX, was really exceptional, not only in terms of the amount of email we received from listeners, but also that Dr. Meller reports that the sales rank of Evolution RX at booksellers like Amazon.com showed that a lot of you who listened decided to buy the book, which is great. Because although we did discuss quite a bit about the topics covered by Evolution RX, the meat is in the details, and you'll get even more information when you read the text of the book itself. Now, this isn't to say that all the feedback was positive, but even for those with questions or concerns about the topics we covered, mostly regarding nutrition, diseases of the body, and physical well-being, you still felt it was an interesting discussion. As Dr. Meller said at the end of our talk, there was a whole other portion of Evolution RX that we hadn't even really touched on. Things like sleep habits, reproductive health, emotional well-being or lack thereof, and relationships. So this week, we're getting a second dose of Dr. William Meller on a completely new set of topics, and we even quickly cover a few of those topics our listeners wrote in about for some rehashing and clarification. Before we get to the second in our two-part series on evolutionary medicine, there are a few quick notes for the skeptical calendar, which is quickly running out of pages for this year. Big congratulations go out to the teams behind the Skeptic's Guide podcast, the Reasonable Doubts podcast, and the Quackcast, who all won podcast awards this past weekend. There were a whole lot of skeptical podcasts nominated for podcast awards this year, and while all who were nominated, including Brian Dunning's Skeptoid podcast, The Hilarious Mr. Deity, Brian Brushwood's Scam School, our good friends over at the Astronomy Cast, and yes, Skepticality, were not able to win this year, considering that there are hundreds of thousands of podcasts out there. To even be nominated, yes, it sounds cliche, but it's so true, is in itself a pretty fabulous thing. And I think we were all pretty excited how many of the limited number of nominations for podcast awards were taken up by skeptics, which speaks to what quality programs are being produced by these folks. Speaking of podcasts, I got the rare opportunity to be a guest on Sasha's Den of Iniquity, which is a cocktail podcast made with several ounces of your favorite mixed drinks and a dash of skepticism thrown in for good measure. The host, Sasha Pixley, was kind enough to invite me to be a guest as he did a show this week about cocktails that feature absinthe. For those of you who enjoyed our recent absinthe episode, and I know a few of you who have already started your own absinthe collections, you can stream the show at www.pixley.net or subscribe to Sasha's Den of Iniquity via iTunes. In even more exciting news, the James Randi Educational Foundation officially announced on December 7th that starting on January 1st, 2010, the new president of the James Randi Educational Foundation will be none other than DJ Grothy, a 10-year veteran of the Center for Inquiry and host of its podcast, Point of Inquiry. I think the JRF has made another excellent choice to replace outgoing president Dr. Phil Plait, who is sad to be stepping down, but as I understand it, he may very well be coming to a television near you very soon, and so we skeptics will have to stop hogging our beloved bad astronomer and share him with the rest of the world. So big congratulations, DJ, and congratulations to the JRF. Of course, the James Randi Educational Foundation headquarters are in sunny Fort Lauderdale on Florida's eastern coast. If you're on the southwest side of Florida, you should know that there's a new skeptics group called the Suncoast Skeptics. Their first event is on January 8th in Sarasota, Florida. You can find out more information about the group and get directions to the meeting on the Suncoast Skeptics Facebook page or at meetup.com/Suncoast Skeptics. After this quick break, I'll be back with our second episode with Dr. William Meller, author of Evolution RX. Dr. Meller is a board-certified internist, as well as one of the United States' leading practitioners of evolutionary medicine. He is a member of the American College of Physicians and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and has also served for more than a decade as a clinical instructor at the University of Southern California. He also co-teaches a pioneering course on evolutionary medicine at the College of Creative Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. As a physician with nearly 30 years' experience, Dr. Meller has seen how the constant barrage of misinformation and outright health hucksterism has caused people to worry unnecessarily and spend needlessly, and that's why he wrote Evolution RX, the first ever book on evolutionary medicine targeted at mainstream audiences.
Hi, Skepticality listeners, I'm Tony Pittman, the presenter of the weekly radio show and podcast Reality Check, broadcast from here in Melbourne, Australia. And if you like listening to Skepticality, maybe you'd like to check out Reality Check. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, that's news related to lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender issues, plus a movie review, plus a serious skeptical analysis of a topic related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. So if that sounds like it could be right up your alley, visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. There you can listen online, download episodes, or subscribe. That's realitycheckonline.net.
You know, we've had a lot of response to the first interview that we did.
That's awesome.
We've had a tremendous amount of response on the website and on the Amazon book sales of just, you know, they've really taken a big jump. So you've got a very dedicated and loyal following who actually listen to your podcast.
That's really great. I'm glad.
Great. Really great.
Well, good. Well, and when we got to the end of our last talk, it was apparent that there was so much more to discuss. And so I was glad that you were interested in doing it, too, because from the feedback we got and everything else, it sounds like people really would like to hear some more of what is going on with Evolution RX. And there's plenty left to talk about, especially mental aspects and things you said, like sleep and all of that. So we'll totally get to that. But I did get some feedback from the last show, a couple of things I might want to go back and touch on again, just to discuss maybe some of the things that people said. Before we get to the sex and the violence in this episode, there were a few contentious emails about the holy grail of subjects, that thing that everybody has a very personal opinion about, that $40 billion a year industry, and that's about diets. And so, you know, even the word diet kind of, you know, makes me a little anxious, but that's the one thing that people seem to be really opinionated about. Is that in your experience too? Diets are definitely an area of contention.
Well, you know, all you have to do is look at the statistics for the annual sale of cookbooks, not to mention the amount of money that people are spending in Weight Watchers and, you know, other proprietary diet programs to know that everybody is working on, and in this country is working on what kind of diet they should be on. And the people who have managed to maintain their weight and be healthy are sure that they've cracked the secret and know that whatever particular fruit, berry, juice, extract, vitamin, or whatever that they're taking is going to be the magic potion for health and long life. So diet is an enormously intimate part of our lives.
Well, and looking at the statistics for obesity and other weight-related, you know, issues in the medical side of things, it's obvious that all of that money that we're spending on diets isn't working.
It is working for some people. I mean, yes, 2/3 of our population is probably overweight, but the other 1/3 isn't. And so the other 1/3, you know, they're doing something right. And it may be that they're on a diet. It may be that they get more exercise. In fact, some people, they probably are thin because they can't afford to eat more. But those people who can, and it doesn't take very much money these days to get more calories than you need on a daily basis, those people struggle because we're naturally designed to eat. Our ancestors lived in a state not of starvation, but certainly on the edge of hunger at all times. And so our evolutionary history is, if there's food around, we should be eating it.
Yeah, because you may not be able to find it later. So, you know, eat it now and save up that energy because you're gonna need it eventually, and there might be a lean time ahead.
That's exactly right. We're tremendously efficient at storing calories for the lean times ahead, because the lean times came at the end of every day, they came at the end of every season, and certainly they came in the time of year when there wasn't so much food around. And I think maybe a lot of the controversy about diet does center around, you know, what kinds of foods are healthy for us, whether or not we should be vegetarian. You know, at what point did humans come down out of the trees, stop eating mostly a fruit and vegetable diet, and start eating meat? And how long did that go on for? And so if we look back 4 or 5 million years, yes, we were fruitarians and vegetarians, the earliest human ancestors. But then for a very, very long period in the Stone Age, when our technology and our accomplishments and our skill at mastering running and mastering weaponry and the organization of the hunt really rose up, we were taking down other animals and eating them with great gusto.
Yeah, we needed first the tools, and then we needed the fire, and after that, you know, it's kebabs for everybody. So
that's exactly right on a daily basis.
Well, yeah, but what you're talking about what we should be eating is pretty much what we got the most feedback about. At least one person thought, because I, not you, mentioned Dr. Atkins and his research into low-carbohydrate diets, that perhaps Evolution RX was advocating an Atkins-style diet. Can you clarify briefly what actually Evolution RX says about meat and healthy fat versus complex carbohydrates and all that?
Well, it's really, you know, we're really omnivores. Again, as Michael Pollan has, you know, pointed out, we can eat everything because we did eat everything. And there are certainly cultures today, you know, that aren't so obsessed with the diet of the moment. If you look historically, they do eat everything. They eat insects, they eat birds, they eat animals, they eat lizards and snakes, you know, and they eat every vegetable that they can get their hands on, every fruit. And that's pretty much how humans evolved. If it was edible, somebody tried it. If it didn't kill them, that it became part of the diet. And considering the fact that our ancestors spread from a very, very small part of Africa around the globe to every single environment possible, it makes a lot of sense that was what it was that we could do. When you look at the Inuit, the Eskimos, and the people who live in the most northern parts of the world, their diet consists largely of seal meat and seal fat. And they have very, very few vegetables. They get, you know, and they only get them in a certain period of time in the year when it greens up or they migrate, you know, somewhat to the south. And then there are other people who live in grasslands where they're only eating deer meat, reindeer, and other animals on the hoof. And so we're evolved to eat pretty much anything that's available. And as long as we can subsist on it, then we're going to live in those parts of the world.
There were also a few vegetarians that were concerned that we were giving them short shrift, that there was plenty of protein in a vegetarian diet, and that eating mostly plants is the way to good health. And pretty much what we discussed about vegetarian diets was you can do it, but there are lots of reasons why it's not optimal.
And that's exactly right. I mean, the fact that humans can exist on a vegetarian diet and that we do have a variety, that's been proven by the hundreds of millions of people that live on a vegetarian diet in India and other parts of the world for religious reasons. And so it definitely can be done. And there is plenty of protein in a carefully selected diet of legumes, beans, rice, and those kind of vegetable products. But for most of us, and especially for children, it's much easier for us to assimilate the kinds of proteins and the kinds of fat that are contained in meat, which isn't to say that you have to do it. Of course, I'm not saying that. It's just that we think that that's probably what our ancestors did.
Well, and there are certainly, while fat is good for all of us, there are definitely some kinds of fat that are better than others.
Animal fat is really what we're talking about, and animal fat is perfectly good for us. It's a very dense source of calories, and there are certain kinds of fat, like the fatty acids that are contained in fish, that are preferentially beneficial because they decrease clotting factors in our blood, and we need them in order to have brain growth, brain and nerve. So fat isn't bad. I mean, you know, people have this idea that because humans get fat when they eat too many calories, that somehow it's the fat that makes us bad. It makes us fat, and then that isn't the case at all. Any excess calories are going to be stored in our bodies as fat. Fat's fine.
We get up in the air and worked up about diets because we all eat, and I suspect another contentious area for different reasons is something else we all do, although it's easy for some of us than others, and that's sleeping. We spend $40 billion a year trying to get better sleep. What are we doing wrong where so many of us are having trouble getting what we think is a good night's sleep?
Well, sleep is just an absolutely fascinating area of medicine and human health. When you think that we spend a third of our lives doing it, pretty much no matter who we are, and yet we still really have no clue about why that is. There's lots of theories that, you know, that about sleep. Is it a regenerative process? Is it something that we did because it was dark and it kept us out of trouble and therefore we were safer if we weren't walking around in the dark? I mean, the fact is that almost all known animals sleep, and we sleep a lot of the time, and we don't really know what it is that's going on. We do know that most healing and almost all growth, physical growth, takes place when we're asleep. It was discovered not too many years ago that growth spurts are a real thing, and that children, when they grow sometimes measurable amounts, meaning macroscopic measurable amounts, several millimeters in a single night, and that happens very, very episodically. So growth is taking place at night, repair is taking place at night. When you're sick, recovery takes place at night. We think that that memory consolidation really takes place when you're asleep, and so that you absolutely must sleep in order to really make sense of what it is that's going on in your world, and dreams are obviously an important part of that. And yet we understand very, very little about it, about the mechanism of it and how to make it happen when it isn't happening well. When we look at the Stone Age and even very, very recent human times, we know that people slept very differently than what we think of today as ideal sleep. Nowadays, if you ask somebody, you know, what's the ideal? What would you really do if you had to? Almost everybody would say, well, 8 hours a night, getting 8 hours a night. And yet, it's very unlikely that that was how our ancestors slept. We know that from electroencephalograms and measuring people's sleep in sleep labs, that most people, all people sleep really in some repetitive cycles of about 90 minutes. It varies between an hour and 2 hours, but on average, about 90 minutes. And the cycle is a cycle of very deep sleep for about 45 minutes and then coming up out of that into sort of a very lighter stage of REM or rapid eye movement sleep for about half an hour and then a period of very, very close to wakefulness and then back down into another deep cycle. And the reason for that is that in the Stone Age, we had to wake up periodically because the environment we lived in was dangerous. And so people waking up in the middle of the night thinking that there's something wrong with that or that wakefulness is harmful are really doing themselves a disservice. It's a perfectly natural thing to do. We just need to know how to adapt to it.
Yeah, I mean, if you slept all night in the Stone Age, you know, you could wake up and everybody else maybe, you know, was eaten by something or you were about to get eaten by something. So it's that sleeping with one eye open type of a thing that, you know, I even kind of do that when I go camping. I mean, when you're not in your normal environment, when you're one of the things you talk about for good sleep is developing your habits. Anytime that habit goes away, that you're in a different environment or a different bed, or for some people, you know, not even the right pillow, you're definitely not going to sleep the same way that you usually do.
Sleep is a habit, just as you say. And it's a habit that we can cultivate and doing the same thing on a regular basis. Anything that we do on a regular basis prior to falling asleep very quickly becomes something that we have to do. And as you said, having the right pillow, having the right temperature, having the right blanket, having our stuffed animal with us, whatever it is that those things are, you know, all of us who have children know that, you know, getting the child into a sleep routine is the key to getting the child to be able to fall asleep well. And that's because it represents security to us and the comfort that we can actually let go of consciousness and yet we're going to wake up and be okay.
Well, yeah, and it makes perfect sense that we definitely do it as children. We do it to our own children, and yet when we get to be adults, we think, you know, we should just be trained to sleep by now. And if we change variables and we don't get as good a night's sleep, it makes perfect sense to me that, you know, if you're changing those variables, you're going to get yourself into a pattern of, you know, less sleep or sleeplessness.
sure. And our culture actually puts us through this very, you know, tumultuous time in our teenage years when we'll pull all-nighters on a regular basis, or when we go to college, or, in our 20s when we go out and go to bars and go drinking and, stay out all night with our friends, or, you know, go on trips and, you know, stay in unusual places, sleep unusual places. It's very, very disruptive to our sleep patterns. And a lot of people, when they get out of the habit, and if they're not conscious and know that what it takes to get back into it, they lose the ability to fall asleep easily, and it takes them years to get back. What often happens is then they'll go to a physician and say, or go to the health food store or whatever and buy some product, or a physician will prescribe some medicine, and then they'll get used to using the medicine to fall asleep. And that's a terrible thing, because it becomes part of their habit. And we know from studying them objectively that most sleeping medications are really pretty useless. They can cause you to be drowsy, but they certainly can't knock you out unless they're very, very strong. And if they are strong, they generally tend to be of a kind of drug that can be very, very addicting. And so the problem is if you give people sleep medicine, then they want to use that same pill every day. The Tylenol PM, anything that contains diphenhydramine or antihistamine, it makes people drowsy, and they end up taking it for years and years and years, even though it's just become part of their sleep routine.
Sometimes I do throw over-the-counter stuff at it, like you say, a Tylenol PM or a Benadryl or something like that. But it's not really worth it for the grogginess that I get when I have to get up. So,
Yeah. You
know, what are things that we can do about sleeplessness? Is it something you should just learn to live with? When you get tired enough, you'll sleep, or what?
Well, there are a number of things that you can do. One thing we can realize is that we don't need to get all of our sleep at night. You know, there's this whole kind of cultural argument, at least in the West, against napping, as if somehow napping is a bad thing, and that the sleep that you get during the day isn't as valuable as the sleep as you get at night, or that somehow it's immoral to be lying down during the day when the sun is shining and sleeping. And that's, of course, completely wrong. There are plenty of cultures in the world where a 2 to 3 hour siesta in the middle of the day after a large meal is considered the height of cultural sophistication, and they live perfectly fine that way. So it doesn't really make any difference when we get our sleep, as long as it works for our lifestyle. And from looking at the sleep patterns of tribes that live in more natural circumstances, or the circumstances they've been in for thousands of years, they sleep several times a day, sometimes 2 or 3 different times a day. They sleep after meals, they sleep after exertion like a hunt, and they sleep at certain periods at night. So really it's the total amount of time that we spend sleeping that we really should count on. And if you don't sleep at night necessarily, don't feel too bad about it if you do get a couple of naps, or at least one long nap during the day. And what can we do about insomnia? Well, we know that there's different kinds of tired. There's physically exerting yourself to the point where you're exhausted. That's a very good kind of tired, and it'll make pretty much any insomniac fall asleep for a certain period of time. And so getting exercise is a really good thing, because it does make you sleepy. There are certain foods that make you sleepy, meaning that if you eat a lot and feel full, then you're going to be sleepier, because your body diverts some of the blood flow that from other parts of physiology into your stomach to help with digestion. And that's a good way of helping you induce periods of sleep during the course of the day. And the other thing is that a lot of insomnia has to do with the circumstances of our life, meaning we live relatively anxiety-producing, stressful, as we like to say now, lives. And dealing with those anxieties and stresses, whatever they are, be they health issues, be they work issues, money issues, family relationships, or whatever, dealing with them and trying to work on them, that can really help people sleep a lot.
Well, so you mentioned anxiety. That's certainly something that is another thing that we all deal with, and stress and things like that in our modern lives. What about our ancestors? They were obviously stressed. I mean, just staying alive is a stressful thing.
Well, we're evolved to handle enormous stresses. I mean, we think of our lives today as being stressful, but we have nothing. I mean, however bad they are for most of us, they're not nearly as bad as having something try to eat you or have somebody trying to stalk up on you and steal your children or take your wife or kill you. And so we're evolved to handle stress. And anxiety is really the anticipation of circumstances in the future that might cause us harm or that might be stressful to us. As soon as our brains evolved the ability to plan even a little bit into the future, which most animals don't have very much of, but we have a lot of. When we got that ability, we bought the whole package. We bought anxiety along with it. And it's not a bad thing, because planning makes our lives a whole lot better. It's really produced all of the culture that we have, you know, other than the, you know, living in the trees and, you know, eating and just collecting the food that we could each day. So we have to understand that anxiety is part of our existence, and it's a beneficial part. When it becomes overwhelming, that's when and interferes with our health and interferes with our sleep and interferes with our enjoyment of life, that's when we really have to deal with it as a problem. But just a normal level of anxiety is not an illness. And that's one of the real insights that evolutionary psychology has had, and that is that a lot of these mental illnesses is that we spend so much time paying attention to and so much time treating with therapy and treating with drugs are not illnesses at all. They're the normal circumstances of human existence. Anxiety, depression, fear, you know, those kind of things really are part of our lives, and we need to understand what good they do us and the benefit that they really bring to us.
Yeah, you mentioned some of those other disorders. Also, ADD or ADHD, that, you know, we've pretty much come to see anybody who's diagnosed with any of these problems as somebody who needs to be medicated and fixed. But evolutionary medicine tells us that there's a reason for a certain amount of ADHD, and it can be useful.
Well, that's right. The earliest description that I could find of anything that sounded like ADHD came from the writings of Hippocrates, and that goes back 2,500 years. And he described people whose attention wandered and who seemed to be restless and who couldn't settle down in circumstances when other people were being able to sit and focus. And that sounds exactly like us, like ADHD to me. It didn't really become a syndrome, a medical diagnosis, until the 60s with something called the hyperkinetic disease of childhood. A woman named Sylvia Chase identified it, and after that, it really burgeoned. And when people start looking for things, when we have a label, then we can find them much more easily. And what we now think is that we think about 5% of the population really are people who find it much more challenging to sit in a quiet room and focus their attention for any extended period of time in one area, either on someone speaking, as in the case of a classroom, or sitting down reading a book, or anything like that. And they just naturally have difficulty with prolonged periods of quiet concentration. So if there is a certain group of humans who have this trait as a genetic trait, it's heritable, we know it runs in families, then evolutionary physicians go back and they look for a reason, or at least a possible reason why this could exist. And the reason we think now that it exists is because it was beneficial, that it protected the people who had it and those around them in some way. And so when you look at the Stone Age and you can imagine a group of people sitting around in a fire, listening to a story, at least listening to the leader tell about the hunt of the day, or having someone, you know, talk about their experiences when they were exploring. If everybody sat down and paid attention to that leader quietly, and had their attention focused on him, and nobody was paying attention to what was going on around that situation, then it would be very easy for them to be snuck up on and attacked, or to have animals jump into and attack them at night. And so we think that there's always been a very small percentage of people, about 1 in 20 people in any particular group of humans, who did have this easy distractibility. And so instead of focusing their attention on what was going on, you know, at the center of the group, they tend to be more peripheral. They tend to wander around. Their attention jumps from thing to thing. And then when their attention is distracted by something that's a danger or a threat, they could warn the group, and that allowed the group to survive. So it is a survival trait.
A good portion of the chapter on evolution from the neck up delves into the use of hypnosis, or simply concentrating or meditating or focusing to be, you know, more aware of certain stimuli, or perhaps the opposite, to be less aware of certain stimuli. Why would this be something our ancestors would do? And if people want to investigate these techniques for themselves, how do we separate legitimate brain science and meditation from quackery?
The This whole area of focusing and attention is fascinating. It really is. It is something that humans are enormously good at. I mean, some people can hold their attention for a very, very long period of time in a very, very narrow focus, or even in their imagination. Like scientists, some scientists are extremely good at abstracting themselves from the world and holding in their minds a model of either the atom or a nerve system or in the case of physicists, how particles interact and manipulating that attention in their minds extensively and even imagining things that can happen. Like, Einstein famously imagined what it was like to ride on a photon at the speed of light. And that's how he was able to imagine what his, what the universe was like, in the relativistic world that he discovered. So some of us are really, really good at that kind of attention. That kind of focus didn't come from studying physics. That kind of focus came in the Stone Age from some need that we had to be able to focus in that way and distract ourselves. And that need probably, and this is hypothetical, of course, that need probably arose from people who needed to be able to ignore bodily sensations and focus on the goal of getting themselves away from danger or getting themselves out of harm's way. So if you're injured, if you spend all of your time thinking about the fact that you're bleeding out and experiencing the pain that's coming from that wound, you're in trouble. What you really need to do when you're injured, either by an animal that's bitten you or falling out of a tree or somebody who attacked you, some enemy that attacked you, is you need to get away. And ignoring, being able to focus your mind on the goal of getting away and ignoring what it was, the physical sensation, was of an enormous value. And so people who were good at that survived. And so people who were good at that, if they survived, they passed on that trait to their offspring. And so this ability to focus and to ignore some sensations and to concentrate on others, that's something that we're really very good at because of the survivors were the ones who are our ancestors. So nowadays it's become very abstracted from that. Nowadays we have that ability, that focusing ability and that ability to narrow our attention, and it's taken many, many different forms. As you said, it's taken the form of meditation. It's taken the form of trance. It's taken the form of hypnosis. And these are all pretty much the same thing. It's the same mental ability, but we give it different names. Science, scientific research and medicine, Western medicine, has had a very hard time getting a hold of this because it's not something that all people can do and not do equally. And it's not something that it's very easy to study. And it produces some pretty spectacular and kind of outlandish effects. People's ability, the things that people can do under hypnosis or in a trance state are not the kinds of things that we generally accept to be, normal human behavior. And so it's been a very problematic area. Some scientists and some Western physicians completely deny the fact that hypnosis exists and say that it's all play acting on the part of the person who's being hypnotized. And we certainly don't have any place in Western medicine for trance states and that kind of thing. So it is a real thing. Your second question, how do we distinguish between quackery and science? That's a very tough question. It is for all of us. I think that the answer is if it's somehow harmful to you or takes away from your control of your life and puts your personality or your personal treasure or your personal safety in the hands of somebody else or someone who wants to manipulate you, that's a dangerous thing, and I would call that quackery. So there are certain religions that very, very clearly are trying to influence us in a way that completely dominates our belief system and makes us act and behave in ways that aren't really beneficial to us as individuals, but really benefit the group or benefit the religious organization. That's something to me that's completely unacceptable.
I agree. I think that's a really good answer, that basically there's just some critical thinking involved there, but some people, kind of go past that because we all want that. We all want that, either that peace that's promised or that healing that's promised or that focus. I mean, I would love to be able to focus that way. I would love to be able to do complex equations in my head and have that kind of focus. And it's just not within my nature to do those things. But yet I've seen people do incredible things that you wouldn't think that they would be able to do. I watched a recent documentary, Running the Sahara, where these three men ran all the way across the Saharan Desert for 111 days they ran. And it's unbelievable what they were able to do running in 140 degree temperatures and all of those things. And the only way they could do that was focusing on their task. It was a great example of focusing and meditation of a sort.
Absolutely. I did see that documentary, and you're right. It was an amazing feat. But I wouldn't sell yourself short. I mean, you know, some people who aren't in the habit of focusing their attention think that they're really not very good at it. But the fact is you probably do things in your daily life where you do focus. I mean, preparing for this kind of podcast, you know, probably takes quite a bit of concentrated attention. The interesting thing that I've found, and I think is very true, is that this the ability to focus is a trainable skill. Meaning, when you first start learning how to meditate or pray, if you want to use the religious term for it, or study, if you want to use the academic term, it's very, very difficult for us to spend more than a few seconds really focusing our attention on anything. But it's like a muscle, only it's a mental muscle. The more we do it, the better we get at it. And there are physical correlates in our brain where, you know, nerve connections are being strengthened and more neurotransmitters being made, and a habit pattern is really being engendered, and it takes time to do that. But if you just sit down for a few seconds one day and pick some object or some thought to focus your attention on, or to use some more of the classical examples, focus on a candle flame or focus on a mantra or whatever, you find at the beginning that it's very, very difficult, and with very, very little practice, you get better at it. And it's an actual physical sensation or a physical feeling that you can then understand. Once you start to feel it, you understand that it's getting stronger, and actually it'll start to show up at other parts of your life. So you focus on a mantra for 15 minutes, of which probably about 25 seconds are actually thinking about the mantra on the first day. But after a week, you're off doing something else. You're reading a book, or you're trying to concentrating, or you're trying to remember something, a phone number or someone's address. And all of a sudden, you can feel your brain go into that same focused and concentrated mode. So you know that focusing muscle is getting stronger. And it's really a very rewarding feeling. And there are lots of very scientific people who spend time meditating because they enjoy the sensation of pure abstract focusing.
If I spent more time and devoted more time to doing that, and I guess that's part of the whole thing about our daily lives, why we don't get enough sleep, why we do all the things that we do, is that we don't think that we've got the time to do that.
Well, I'm not saying that you have to either. I mean, I'm not telling people that going out and meditating is going to solve a lot of their problems. I'm just saying that this is a human function that we're capable of.
Well, sure. It's like anything else. It's a practiced behavior, and it's another one of those things like exercising or eating the right foods or getting to sleep at night. It has to become a habit, and it's a healthy habit to have if you find that you're not good at concentrating, which I'm not. So
it's a very good habit to have, and that is really one of the more natural answers to ADD or ADHD. And as a physician, I'm certainly not adverse to using medication. I do, you know, both in children and adults who come to me who have focusing and attention problems. Those drugs really do help, and they help miraculously, and they're really rather wonderful to have because it's very hard to do it the other way. But I also talk to my patients about this natural ability that we have and try to get them to practice other forms of focusing, because I know that it's going to help them as well.
Well, and another place that it's probably extremely helpful, in fact, I know that it is in recovering stroke patients or anyone who's had a brain injury where your short-term memory may be affected or your anxiety level is up because everything is difficult. So being able to practice on just being able to focus may be completely necessary to being able to function or return to work.
That's right. And not too many years from now, we're going to be able to actually identify the neurologic correlates of that and be able to follow the increased nerve pathway regeneration, the increased neurotransmitter regeneration, and all the synapses that are the actual physical correlate of that, because there's no question this is all happening physically inside our brains.
Our brains are so amazing. I never get tired of hearing about, as you said, the thought of the focusing and the whole thing about the way that our minds work and how they've always worked. You're right. It's one of the more fascinating parts of your book, I have to say.
Thank you very much. The interesting thing to me is that this idea that evolutionary psychology has our brains are kind of a toolkit, that we didn't get them all at once. We can actually follow the evolutionary development of the human brain back now through almost 7 million years by looking at the different the size and the interior shape of the skulls of the fossils that we've discovered. We can really see the brain developing from its most primitive, most basic, more central, lower neurologic functions up to this beautiful flowering cortex that we got within the last couple of 100,000 years that'll really allow us to have the kind of complex thoughts that we have. And so this, the anatomical correlates of all of these psychological traits that we have is really getting very well mapped out at this point.
Well, but what's great too is through reading Evolution RX, you can take these complex things and these very, what seem to be, you would think, complicated habits and emotions that we've developed and trace them back to how simple they really were to begin with. Like our Stone Age brains give us clues about why we like to go shopping, why we like to acquire things. Not the having of things per se, but the hunting and the finding and acquiring of stuff that many of us need, some retail therapy from time to time because we just can't get enough of going and getting stuff.
Yeah, so many people think of that, think of shopping as something bad. I mean, the people who shop love to shop, and they're not going to rationalize it or explain it to anybody. But people who criticize it think, why do you want to go out and buy, why do you have 40 pairs of shoes? How could you possibly need another dress? What do you mean you need another tool in the garage when you've got 45 other tools that do almost exactly the same thing? And the answer is because we get a charge. We get a real burst of pleasure out of the seeking and the finding of things that we enjoy or that we use. And the reason that we get that charge is because back in the day, back in the Stone Age, we needed to be very, very persistent at hunting and gathering and finding. And the basic things that we were hunting and gathering and finding was food. And we had to do it pretty much all day long. Our earliest ancestors probably spent as long as 10 to 11 hours a day collecting enough calories to get them through that day. And so you couldn't lose interest. You couldn't stop at some point, because you would starve. And so our brains evolved in order to reward us with its thought to be the neurotransmitter dopamine. But when we were out in the pursuit of what it was that we needed, basically food. So it really is the pursuit of things that gives us some of the greatest reward. It isn't necessarily the acquiring of them. And in modern terms, we think of this in terms of something known as buyer's remorse, meaning sometimes that you go out and you're hunting and you buy something, a big house or you get a new car or whatever, and you're really enjoying the whole time, the whole pursuit of deciding and choosing and making the decision. And then once you've acquired it, there's a certain letdown. There's a sort of feeling of, what was all that about? And so it really isn't the acquiring is so much as it is the pursuing that keeps us motivated.
Yeah, I've had that before where, I've especially like at Home Depot or something, and I find like you said, 50 tools that I don't need, but they're so cool. And so I will have gathered up a whole bunch of stuff and I've taken long enough to do it that by the time I've done it, I realize that it's kind of superfluous and it's over. The high part is over. And so, I'll walk away and not buy anything. And it's still just as great because think about all that stuff you just found or all that stuff you just saw and then you didn't have to spend the money and come home with it unnecessarily.
Right. And there are tricks. I mean, there are ways of getting around that remorse. I mean, there are people become collectors because they're trying to feed that emotional sensation that we're talking about. But I remember, walking in on my teenage daughter once when she was on the computer not too many years ago. And I asked her what she was doing. And she said, well, I'm filling up my shopping cart. And I said, what do you mean? Because she didn't have a credit card at that point, and she wasn't able to spend any money. She would go online to clothing stores and jewelry stores and just put tens of thousands of dollars worth of items in her shopping cart and have the feeling that she was acquiring it. And then she'd get to the end and click and close the website, and that was the end of that. But she had the feeling that she was out hunting and gathering, and it gave her a tremendous sense of satisfaction.
Yeah, that's awesome. I do that sometimes on Amazon. You build your wish list, and it's not anything you're going to ever get, but you found all this stuff that you thought you wanted, and you don't have to buy anything. So that's an awesome trick. Definitely.
Yeah, that's a great trick.
Well, and you can do it virtually. I think that's another clue to why, like, massive online role-playing games like World of Warcraft are so popular, because basically the entire game is questing for stuff. It's hunting and gathering experience with rewards, and so you're virtually getting and finding and gathering constantly, which is why some people spend so many hours of their day doing it, but they're not actually getting anything. They just feel as good as they are.
It's totally addicting. You're absolutely right. That's what they're doing. They're accumulating gold, weapons, charms, spells, you know, allies and stuff like that. And it's completely addicting because the chemicals that are produced in our brain with addicting drugs are the same chemicals that are released when we're shopping.
Well, see, that's so awesome because there's so many ways to fulfill that need that we have ingrained within us without breaking our bank or hurting our wallet. So that's good to know. What about the hunting and acquiring of friends? I mentioned on our last program that our brains have a limited capacity for how many friends we can really deal with. And now, even though we may not be close friends with 700 people on our Facebook, we do virtually communicate with a vastly larger circle of people than probably ever before. So do clues from our evolution show that this could be problematic, that we're stretching ourselves too thin by trying to know too many people at once?
When we look at humans in the Stone Age environment, they really lived in very small groups, 15, 20 people in any immediate group. And then probably during the course of their whole lifetime, they really never encountered more than about 150 actual living beings. And so that's a relatively small number compared to the millions that we at least pass in the street today. So we think that our brains are optimized in a way to really hold into, you know, as different personality types or individuals, around 150 people as a sort of a maximum number. And when we look at human organizations, meaning military units or academic societies or departments in a school or classes and stuff like that, this 150 people, 147 was the number that a guy named Robin Dunbar came up with. And it does seem to be a relatively significant number of people. But nowadays what's happened is that since we have contact with so many more people, a lot of those contacts are seem to be much shallower, and that we tend to group people as certain types, or we put them, you know, this is somebody who I only email with, or this is somebody who's on my, you know, on my podcast list, or this is somebody who's a Twitter follower or whatever. Those are not the same kind of relationships that we're talking about when we talk about the intimate relationships that people have.
That somewhat explains something to me, though, that with a lot of my friends who are skeptics and things like that, we have very close-knit online groups, but it's become a very regular thing now to have face-to-face meetups and conventions like that. And I know people who can do that, you know, several days a week, every day, because those shallow relationships that we're building online, we want more from them. And so people are going to, you know, great distances and sometimes great expense to be able to have better contacts with those people that they're meeting online now. Because I think we get that feeling that if it's not a closer personal, if I'm not shaking your hand actually or looking you in the eye, it's not as fulfilling a relationship.
Oh, there's no question. We want human contact. And that we want it with people who approve of us and are probably similar to us, people who we would, in the old days, would consider part of our family. We need that. We get an enormous amount of satisfaction and encouragement from being around other people. Most of us do. I mean, obviously, there are hermits and people. But, you know, in all these things, we exist on a spectrum from the people who really need very little contact at all to the people who, you know, think of themselves as having 1,500 close personal friends and contact with them on a regular basis. But most of us tend to fall in somewhere in the middle, where, you know, having 10, 15, 20 people who we really think of as our friends, and maybe a larger group of 50 that we interact with daily, and maybe 150 who we really think of on a, you know, maybe a weekly basis, is something that, you know, gives us enough satisfaction to feel like we have a large enough group of supporters.
Well, in all these groups and all these people, we know we have a larger pool of people with which to gossip. It's yet another behavior that we're told is unseemly, but everybody does it, and there may be very good reasons why we do.
A gossip really gets very, very bad press, and yet it gets a lot of press. there are entire industries, as we well know, that exist for no other reason other than to spread gossip about people. And there has to be a reason for this. It isn't just that we're all interested in salacious rumors about Tiger Woods' multiple mistresses. You know, the fact is that gossip is something that all people have done since the earliest days. And the reason is because gossip is the coinage of trust. Gossip is the language. It's the kind of speech that we use to let our intimate fellows know about who we can turn our back on and who we should never, ever, you know, close our eyes around, and who's going to cut and run when we need them, and or who's going to share their last piece of food with us. That's what we're really all gossiping about. And, of course, sexual fidelity is one of the biggest subjects that gossip covers, because back in the Stone Age, humans and other primates obviously needed to know, you know, who was the father of whom, who was going to be running away at the turn of a leaf, you know, with some male from down the down the valley. And so we're evolved to love gossip. Dishing dirt is just something that humans are really, really great at, and it's condemned by social organizations that really want to take the place of those gossip. So basically, you know, churches tell us not to gossip, and you know, schools tell us that gossip is harmful because they're trying to give us a different set of information that they want us to believe. You know, that there are a different set of rules that they think we should live by, whereas the rules that we really do live by are very intimate and very personal, and really have to do with who do you trust? You know, who can you trust? Who can you count on? And who can't you count on? And that's what gossip is all about. Now, nowadays, it's been abstracted from the essential information that we needed, which was, did someone pee in the water hole, you know, and did someone have sex with that other woman back, you know, behind your back, to, you know, what's Oprah say? Or, you know, who is Tina Fey going out with tonight? And the reason for that is that it's the same mechanism. We still think that these people, these celebrities who we hear about on a daily basis, are in some way our close, personal, intimate friends. Because since we see their pictures and since we hear about them so frequently, they've come to occupy in the minds of very many people their immediate family. And so the celebrity gossip industry is preying, or at least capitalizing, I should say, on a very, very personal human function that we've had for millions of years in order to survive, and they're doing it in a very clever way. And when you think about it, social media are exactly the same thing. Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, Friendster, you know, all of the social media that have arisen over the last 10 or 15 years are really just another way to gossip about people and hear what it is that people are up to.
Yeah, with more instant gratification. And the possibility of being able to gossip anonymously, because you can say you're one person and then again you're not, so you're safe, but you can dish dirt on anybody you want to. Not that I've ever done that, but yeah, exactly. Well, so you talked about affairs, and of course, yeah, it seems like every other day there's somebody else in the public eye admitting to an affair or getting caught for cheating. But as I read it, women statistically cheat at least as often as men, but are they just better at not getting caught, or do men not care if women cheat as much? Why is it that it seems like most of the time it's men who are being vilified for cheating, when women do it statistically as much as men?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I think the answer is because they're better at it. Certainly men care. There's no question that men care. You know, because when a woman cheats, if she happened to get pregnant by that cheating, that's a huge investment for the guy to raise somebody else's child. I mean, that's the primal case. Whereas when a guy cheats, you know, he's going off and, you know, he can spread his seed around pretty far, and it doesn't really cost him, and like, except in a modern legal system, if he gets caught, it doesn't cost him all that much. So I think women must be actually sneakier.
I'm not gonna comment on that. But yeah, you mentioned about the knowing whose child belongs to whom. Shockingly, there's a statistic in your book that says that 15 to 30% of children were not necessarily fathered by the person who thinks they are the child's father. And so females being more nurturing, not only necessarily based in the hormones and the carrying of the child and the 9 months and giving birth, but women know for sure that that child came out of their body, so it's definitely theirs. But men don't necessarily have that assurance, do they?
That's exactly right. And the corollary to that statistic is that it's very much related to socioeconomic class, so that in less affluent economic classes, there are more children whose fathers are who the real father is unknown, whereas the higher socioeconomic class you go, the more likely it is that the father is the real father of the child. So this must mean that this whole thing is intimately tied up with support. And that's really what men are good for. I mean, yeah, that's exactly right. We impregnate women, and that's part of our role. But the other part of our role is supporting and raising that child when we think that that child is our offspring. Women, as you said, they know. So they're dedicated. Women give birth to a child. There's nothing that's going to get in the way short of, serious circumstances to prevent them from spending the next 18 to 20 years taking care of the child. Whereas men, they tend to have more loose allegiance, maybe because of this this questioning. One of the fascinating things that I found in this most recent release of the information about Ardipithecus, the new skeleton that was recently discovered, or it was discovered for a while ago, but the information really came out about it in the last 6 months, was how long ago they feel it speaks to the monogamous or at least pair bonding human relationship. And they felt, some of the scientists that worked on the skeleton felt, that this 4.5 million year old early human ancestor really shows strong evidence that pair bonding was an important part of the relationship that far back. And if that's the case, that makes us very, very different from most other large mammals out there. Other large mammals that are out there today, primates and even herd animals like deer. And that may be a very important thing to humans, is that if pair bonding is an essential part of making us human, that tells us a lot about why it is that all of these things, gossip and cheating and marriage for that matter, are important to us.
That really surprises me, the thoughts about pair bonding and monogamy, because I would have thought, it's kind of the whole it takes a village thing. And I would suspect that I would like to think our ancestors maybe didn't care as much about the monogamy portion as long as everybody was taken care of. That's what I would think. But if it turns out that that's not the case, that certainly is extremely interesting.
It's extremely interesting, and villages didn't actually arise until all that recently. I mean, a village, when you think about it, that's multiple families living in the same area, probably as many as 10 or 15 families. That's a relatively recent phenomenon. You're talking 10 or 15,000 years ago. Before that, it was really just bands,
yeah,
which were related people, or a tribe, which was a descending in the same hereditary line. So really, we're talking about families before that. So villages are relatively new.
Right. So that's true. That kind of changes the perspective. That's really interesting. That's really interesting. So if monogamy is more ingrained in us, what's with all the cheating?
Well, cheating has to do with increasing the quality of your gene pool. So women, they tend to cheat with men of higher status, meaning better looking or better off. They don't cheat down. And so a woman, when she's fertile, she has more sexual desire, which we pretty much know is the case, then if she's going to cheat, she's going to cheat with somebody who she thinks is going to add to the survival characteristics and survival trait and benefit of the offspring that she's going to give. Men are different. Men tend to cheat down, or at least they cheat easy. They're not cheating with someone, high status woman or, extremely attractive woman. It's the woman who's doing the choosing.
Yeah, there's nothing not to like about that. Well, and I also read in part of this book, and the way that you put it, I could almost, hear a lot of my friends just, breaking out into applause that, quote, men gravitate toward women who enjoy sex and seek them out repeatedly. Women who are good at sex have more of it, often with more partners. So that's great, too. not only are women better at possibly concealing their cheating, but they'll end up with men who gravitate toward them because they may enjoy sex more and are better at sex. So you're getting chosen for a good reason.
That's exactly right. And when you say conceal, you bring up a very interesting subject. Human females are the only mammal that we know of that conceals ovulation. There's some talk about some whale species, I don't know very much about it, that might have a concealed ovulation. But human women don't actually know when they're ovulating. And certainly human men don't know. So that's got to be an absolutely key aspect of our evolutionary development. And all of the ramifications and significance of that have not been worked out. I certainly haven't been able to sort them all out, and I don't think I've read any article that really does. But I really think that speaks enormously to the power that women have in human relationships that they don't have in many, many other species.
Well, we certainly covered a lot more of the mental aspects and the things that happen, between our ears. And as you mentioned before, and it is spelled out well in your book, there is no brain-body separation, that the mind and the body are all one thing. And it certainly seems that it dictates a lot of the things that we do, or basically everything that we do, whether we like it or not. We were talking about all the fun and the sex and the gossip and all of that stuff, but there definitely is the downside. There's depression. It's kind of the flip side of anxiety. So
depression and grief, which is a very natural thing. These are natural human emotional states, and yet nowadays we diagnose them as diseases and we treat them with pills and we treat them with a massive amount of medication. And there's very, very little evidence that the medicine is effective. When we look at the actual clinical trials of antidepressant medicines, they may possibly be beneficial in about 1 out of every 7 people who are taking them. And yet millions and millions of people take them on a daily basis. And when we go back and look at, depression and try to understand what it is that's going on, there is a natural case for why humans need to be depressed at times. Humans generally get depressed when they've experienced a loss. And it can be pretty much any kind of loss. The original losses, of course, were loss of an individual when someone died or when someone was injured or someone left the tribe. And those losses, we need to spend time to recalculate our existential position in the world without that person in order to be able to go forward most effectively. If we didn't do that time, if we didn't sit back, get quiet, and rethink about what our circumstances were, we would have been in a lot of trouble back in the Stone Age because we could have been tripped up by not having that person around. So that's really the primal situation for grief. And the loss of things and objects and wealth and status and tools, that's the kind of circumstance, our job, that we get depressed in now. And so what depression is telling us is sit back and spend some time and think about this thing. Reassess, recalculate, refocus, make a new plan, come up with some other way of being in the world. And yet the modern answer is go to the doctor and take these pills, and these pills should alleviate that emotional state. Well, that's a terribly counterproductive thing to do. Now, obviously, there's situations where depression can get out of hand, and there are people who, because of the fact that there are now billions of us and not just tens of thousands, they get overwhelmed by the kind of depression that exists, and people can really actually be depressed their entire lives because of the biological nature of their particular mental equipment. And those people can benefit in some cases from medication. And certainly, I'm not saying that people shouldn't take medicine at times or that people don't benefit. Some of the people don't benefit. But depression is a real thing, and depression has things to teach us, and we really do need to pay attention to it rather than just try to medicate it away.
We tend to medicate in many of these circumstances for sleep, for
anxiety,
over shopping, for cheating, for all of these things that we turn to for drugs and pharmaceuticals. It's a time issue because we want it to get fixed right away. And that's not what our ancestors would have been able to do. They didn't have time to take out of their survival to think about that kind of thing. But they had their own downtime, that thinking and reflection and having downtime is not necessarily something that just us couch potatoes do. It's something that our ancestors did as well, that they weren't go, go, go all the time because they had to conserve energy.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, once you get to the point where humans discover fire, which we think, I mean, there's arguments about it, but it's got to be between 500,000 and 1.5 million years ago. Once humans discovered fire, we had leisure time like nobody's business, because once you can cook your food, that made an enormous difference in how much time you needed to spend chewing and eating. And so if you could hunt a large enough animal, which we got very good at very soon, and then cook it, we could sometimes sit around for days with nothing to do. And so when that happened, we did. That was the birth of culture. You know, we'd kill an animal, cook it, and then sit around and not do much until we got hungry again. And what the not do much involved was making better spear points, telling stories, carving wood, carving stone, making little objects, making decorations, doing tattoos, all those other things that humans do, you know, to engage themselves during their leisure time. That was as a result of the luxury that we had that really fire and cooking brought to us. And so we're very, very good at sitting around and thinking about stuff.
Well, so it sounds like if maybe we do maybe a little more quality leisure time, spend some of that time, you know, doing some meditation and focusing and thinking about things that are wrong and practicing our good habits of, you know, eating the right things and planning out how we sleep and taking naps, then we're going to be better off all the way around.
I don't know. Television's pretty. I like the Big Bang Theory, and I got some other favorite shows. So you know, there's a lot of TV out there that I think is pretty quality time that I can sit around on the couch and do.
I'd like to wrap up with one of my favorite quotes that's in Evolution RX, and I think it's a great statement for everyone, and it's certainly something that every skeptic I know can certainly identify with. You say, "I don't guarantee a long life. I'd be some doctor if I could. Just remember that evolution makes common sense. Be practical and be skeptical of all health claims. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. On the other hand, keeping the evolutionary origins of your health in mind can stack the odds for a very long life in your favor."
Well, thank you very much, and I've really enjoyed talking with you. As I mentioned earlier, you have a very, very loyal audience, and a lot of people have picked up the book in the last several weeks, and it's been mentioned on a lot of blogs that we had never managed to reach prior to my first conversation with you, and so I thank you very much for the attention that you've given to my book.
Well, I thank you so much because you provided us with so much interesting content. As I mentioned before, there's a lot of information in Evolution RX that is covered in even greater detail than Dr. Meller and I discussed in our two interviews. I still highly recommend picking up a copy. And as we learned, we shouldn't feel quite so guilty about shopping. We've evolved to need to go out and get stuff. Granted, you don't need a Kindle or a Terry's Chocolate Orange for survival, but then again, some people I know might disagree. As of this recording, you've got 10 days left until Noodlemass. So it's not too late to buy a gift subscription to Skeptic Magazine or a copy of Evolution RX for that member of your family who gave you a bottle of Airborne last year instead of the Skeptudes calendar that you asked for. If you click on the affiliate links at skeptic.com or via the links in our show notes at skepticality.com, you can help out the Skeptic Society anytime you shop at amazon.com, amazon.ca, amazon.co.uk, Amazon.de, iTunes, abooks.com, and barnesandnoble.com. The Skeptic Society, which is a nonprofit organization, will make a commission off of every purchase you make. What a great way to put that deeply ingrained shopping instinct to work for a good cause. Speaking of the holidays, we'll be having what I think will end up being a really fabulous and special Christmas, yes, I said Christmas, episode of Skepticality at the beginning of next week. So be sure to check back in before you fall into an eggnog coma, or you'll miss all the fun.
Join our discussion forums at www.skepticality.com. Leave feedback by email at feedback@skepticality.com or by phone at area code 206-888-HOAX. That's 206-888-4629. This has been Skepticality. Thanks for listening.